So, Dave, this situation actually happened to you, although in a very different airplane. What happened?
I was in a Pitts S1, a single-seat aerobatic biplane, and I was practicing for an aerobatic contest. I had my sequence card. I'm practicing the sportsman routine. The last maneuver is a 45-degree climbing roll. And I remember that as I throttled up to do that maneuver, the throttle felt a little strange. Continued the maneuver, leveled off, and the linkage had broken. So the throttle handle was connected to nothing. It was a 180 horsepower 0360 engine and a really flat pitched propeller, fixed pitch, flat blades. And I just remember that it didn't take much time at all for the RPMs to really wind up. I mean, it was, you know, well above 3000 RPM. And my decision at that point was either to go back to my home field, which was about a 3,500 foot runway, about 10 miles away. And about equidistant was another airport with a 5,000 foot plus runway. And they were both non-towered. So I wasn't talking to anybody. So I only had a few hundred hours flying time then. And I just thought, well, let me just go to the long runway. You know, it's like, but I haven't done a, you know, I know I'm going to have to kill the engine to land. How about I just make things easy for myself by going to the longer runway? So I did that, and it was, you know, it was pretty much straight in. It was an overhead approach. It was, I think it was about 1200 AGL. Boy, I just remember the RPMs were so high, and the noise level was incredibly loud. But I just, you know, announced my intentions. Went, you know, it was a quiet evening. There wasn't anybody else in the pattern at the time. Just flew over the numbers at about 1200 AGL. Pulled the mixture, and I just remember it being struck by how normal it all felt. That the airplane flew really well. It was not a dramatically steeper descent than a regular power off descent. You know, and I just you know, kept that left turn coming all the way, you know, and onto final approach, and then, you know, just made a nice tight pattern, and the propeller kept windmilling all the way into the flare. You know, I mean, I was just flaring to land when the prop finally ticked to a stop, and you know, I remember being thankful I was on the ground, nothing bad happened to the airplane. And then I realized that it was going to be a long, you know, I had to push that airplane a long way to get it to the ramp. I mean, it was over a mile in the evening in the Mississippi Delta. The mosquitoes come out and they get hungry. So I just remember, you know, pushing this airplane, being completely sweaty and just getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. And fortunately, there was Wayne Marshall, a friend of mine who happened to be based at that airport, came out with his pickup truck, and we brought the pits back to his hangar.
Wow. So the worst part of an engine emergency are the mosquitoes on the ground. I love it. That's, you know, great way to turn something that gets the adrenaline just pumping into a non-event. But I got to ask, Dave, what you just said was that you stayed flying level at absurdly high RPM, it felt like, with noise and all the stress accompanying that. But for this scenario pilot, if you put yourself in their shoes, you're going to say climb and spiral down from much higher. Why
right.
The difference?
Yeah,
why?
That's a good point. You know, in the aerobatic world, you know, high RPMs and, you know, well above red line, it's fairly a normal part of what aerobatic pilots do. But I'd suggested the climb and keeping it under red line because of something I learned while researching this scenario. And that is that that excessive RPMs are really serious from the engine manufacturer standpoint. And, you know, a prolonged period at super high RPM, you know, requires a, you know, removing the engine, tearing down the engine, and not reusing a lot of the parts, which is new information for me. Also, you know, it was about a 10-mile transit from the practice area to this airport. So, it never occurred to me to climb to keep the RPMs down.
You know, I'm going to turn to our A&P at the table here and say, you know, Dean, from an engine manufacturer's point of view, sure, I can see why if it's an overspeed, like they're going to be super conservative. But from the pilot's point of view and the likelihood of metal parts flying out the side of that cowling, how much of a concern is just being 300 RPM too high for a little while? Or are there any other concerns about this situation that the pilot should be thinking about?
Well, first of all, when I read this scenario, one of my biggest questions was, is this even reasonable or is this even possible? And so I had to really think about it a lot and do some research. And apparently, yes, it is. But I'm still kind of curious about what happens in, say, for example, a Cessna 172 with an 0320 engine, how fast you could even possibly get that prop moving, the engine moving at full power at either, well, at level flight, since that's our scenario here. I'm not sure it would even go to 3000 RPM. So, but in this case, apparently it will. And one thing that struck me about this one is that to me, it's a bit of an out of the ordinary situation because the IO240 engine is a fuel injected engine, but yet we have a fixed pitch propeller on it. And I usually think of a fuel injected engine having a constant speed prop, that type of combination. So it's an interesting combination we have on this diamond. But as far as the overspeed, I think I have what I would refer to as a healthy fear of exceeding the engine limitations. And so I don't really like the idea of, for example, over boosting a turbocharged engine, or in this case, having the RPMs go significantly above the maximum allowable. So I think it is a very significant and something that's very important and could be dangerous.
It must be torture for you, Dean, to watch the like the Reno air races, because those Formula Ones with the Continental O200s are regularly turning in excess of 4,000 RPM.
Okay, so now, Dave, now I got to go watch that right after we're done here. So, yeah, that's a good point. But back to this scenario, I did find some of that information that you referred to, Dave, and the Continental has some definite guidance on it, and it might be helpful to consider that the service bulletin that Continental put out, it came out many years ago, service bulletin 05-2, it came out in 2005, and then somewhere along the way, they put all their information in their maintenance manual that they call M-O, and so I think that is in there now. But then I also found a type certificate page, a type certificate data sheet page for the IO240 engine, and it just says 10 seconds as a momentary overspeed, 3,000 RPM. And then it says, see the latest revision of Continental Standard Practice Maintenance Manual. That's the M-O. So I think what they've done is they've taken that service bulletin and they've incorporated it into their engine maintenance manual. And then one last thing, a service bulletin for a Part 91 operator is not actually a required thing. So that would be another interesting thing to talk about, because this is not an airworthiness directive, and it's also not in Chapter 4 airworthiness limitations. So it's not actually absolutely required. So it's probably a wise thing to do, but there is probably a fair amount of room for some individual judgment on the part of the airplane owner and the A&P to decide how long was it overspeeding, and then what do we do about it?
Well, it sounds like there's a regulatory morass after you land somewhere that's going to be as thick as those mosquitoes that were on Dave and after his landing. But from this pilot's point of view, you don't have any of that information. That pilot's going to have to make a decision just based on a little mark on the tachometer and their best guess. Paul, you had something to say.
Yeah, earlier I had wondered about how many of these installations have a fail to wide open. And I think, well, Dave kind of answered it. This is an aerobatic engine, so I bet the AIO engines have that. Because the only other place I've encountered it is with Rotax engines, and specifically the Rans. I flew a Rans once, and the throttle basically sprung to wide open. You had to adjust the friction nut to keep it from going open. There may be others that are set up this way. I just have never encountered one. Also, I would make an argument for using the mixture here. Although I would do this scenario exactly the way Dave described it, I would not rule out using mixture, particularly with the io240. The io240 has two things going for it: fuel injection, and it's got top down induction, so it's very smooth. And so when you lean it past a lean of peak all the way to stumble rough, it will continue to function, and it will just lose power, and the EGTs will come down. And when we were testing and installing gam ejectors, we would routinely pull the engines back smoothly to the point where they just stopped running. And then you're enriching it slightly and they come back with a little bit of power. So there's the likelihood of engine damage is just about nil, because you're just going to reduce the EGTs. The engine's going to run a lot cooler. It's not going to make any power. So I would submit that you keep that as an option, but not necessarily the first option.
You know, one of the things I find interesting here is that everybody agrees that they're going to climb heading back to the airport to Millington, and they're going to spiral down. How much of that around the table is for keeping the RPM down, and how much of that is to be high over the airport when you kill the engine and keep your options open for the descent? I can see Kevin's kind of nodding his head there. So I'm curious, Kevin, does that play into your decision more than the RPM, or what's the balance there?
For me, it's both of those things. The probably a bigger deal is the idea of having more options available to me. I like that idea in most situations. But the other side of it is, it probably wouldn't be enough to make that much of a difference, but when you climb, you're going to, in a naturally aspirated engine, you're going to lose a little bit of power anyways, just from the air being less dense as you climb. So you might be able to do yourself a favor that way by climbing. But I would say that would be second to keeping the options open.
Right. So that played in more. Was that true for anyone else? I'm really curious here, because we're not talking about a lot of overspeed here. Katrina.
Yeah, I also fell more under the option of, or choosing that option, I should say, just to keep lots of options for myself. Sure, we could say it's not that much overspeed. It's still something in the vicinity of over 10%. But anytime we see an engine in distress, in whatever way it's in distress, we need to be expecting a complete failure as a possibility. And of course, altitude is always our friend in that situation. My personal preference as an instructor or practice, I should say, is I will take a student out before we even practice a power off kind of scenario and make sure that they know what kind of altitude they're going to lose in this airplane at best glide speed, so that you can kind of plan ahead for how many circles you can make overhead given an altitude, and look at your loss. And so this procedure under option three, and the way that Dave described it, is pretty much exactly how I teach engine failures to students anyway.
What that makes me wonder is the throttle linkage failure, right, is a pretty specific but interesting scenario that clearly can happen. But the need for the emergency landing, they're all kinds of possibilities here. Dave brought up the overhead approach and spiraling down over the airport. Maybe I'll put this to our glider pilot and examiner at the table here. How does a pilot add this to their repertoire, especially if it's not part of the private pilot curriculum? This pilot has less than 50 hours and they're flying an airplane that's going to really glide.
Well, Dave certainly I agree with his choice to put yourself over the field, put yourself on downwind at approximately 1,000 feet above field elevation. In the gliders, that's the way we teach the pilots from day one. And whether they're landing at the airport or whether they happen to be landing in a field somewhere, If they put themselves in that position, the approach is always the same. So the way we can do that as power instructors is to, whether the maneuver is required by the PTS or not, it's certainly a maneuver we should practice, and certainly part of all of my flight reviews. And I encourage all the pilots I fly with to practice it, because usually the first time they try it, they'll muck it up. They won't make it. However, if they've just done two or three of them and then they're faced with a scenario like Dave was, they can say, gee, I did this 2 weeks ago and it worked out. So it's a maneuver that we all need to practice, whether it's required for our rating or not.
You know, Dave, one of the things you mentioned was adjusting the glide in a curving approach is going to be easier than in even just a regular pattern or a long straight in approach. How can a pilot, especially if they want to practice, like Wally says here, practice that adjustment of the glide without causing some potentially dangerous situation close to the ground?
Well, it's just you've got more tools in your kit bag. You know, you can vary the bank angle, you can slip, you can adjust the back pressure, the pitch attitude, and how much drag you're inducing. And if you're in a if you're in a straight ahead glide, you're typically just trying to maximize the distance. And also, you know, the way we practice, if you give a student pilot a straight in approach to a runway, they're much more likely to have difficulty with it than they would if they're told to fly the pattern. And that's so much the case that when I have a student soloing, I'd instruct them to fly the pattern at their destination airport. Do not make a straight in approach, because they typically find, speed and rate of descent harder to manage.
Wally, then Kevin.
I want to go back to what Dave said about the slip. That's another tool that a lot of pilots really are not very good at. And it's an awesome tool in this scenario, because with a slip, you can put it in and take it out. With flaps, typically you're sort of restricted to putting them on, and now you're stuck with them. So a slip is a great tool. And again, it's a tool that needs to be practiced.
Kevin.
When it comes to any sort of abnormal or emergency situation, something you're dealing with, I think it's a lot easier to deal with those things if you've been there before in some capacity, whether it's experience or training or any number of things. And also, when you find yourself in that emergency situation, I think it's helpful if you can keep things as normal as possible. For the discussion of a downwind versus a straight in, the straight in when your engine out is going to be a lot more difficult to judge keeping normal, because your normal 3-degree glide path with power on is just not going to cut it with an engine failure. Where your sight picture out the window on a downwind flying a normal pattern, that's something that you can adjust, like what Dave was saying, a lot easier. And when you're doing it with an engine failure, you're able to be a lot closer to what your normal is. And I think that's going to set you up for more success.
Dean, then Paul, then Katrina.
Yeah. The biggest thing that I don't like about the straight in approach is that if I try that maneuver, and especially as Kevin was saying, in an out of the ordinary situation, I'm afraid I might get too low. And I think there's a much greater chance I will get too low on a straight in rather than a spiraling down approach.
Paul.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dean. I was about to say, from the engine failure research and analysis I did, on the engine failure accidents that went wrong, the predominant reason they went wrong is, or two reasons. One was pilot may have picked an acceptable landing spot, but he screwed up the approach, and more commonly came up short rather than long. And the second finding, which kind of surprised me, was the off-speed problem, and it wasn't being too slow, it was being too fast. So if they picked a field that looked good, but they bollocked up the approach and were coming up short and were going to hit unfavorable terrain or trees or whatever, they didn't slow down. So what should have been survivable turned out to be unsurvivable by dint of speed.
Katrina.
I think I'm kind of just summing this up a little bit of what Kevin and Dean were both saying, but I've always said this to students: why would you put yourself in an unusual situation when you're in the middle of an emergency which doing a straight in is an unusual situation for most pilots. You've seen a traffic pattern over and over and over and over again, especially this pilot, because they've just a lot of time in the pattern learning how to land. That's the thing you're most familiar with judging. And so why do something that you've never done before in a situation where you're already experiencing something you've never had happen to you before?
You know, what I find really interesting here is that all of you have kind of coalesced around this idea that, I'm going to borrow Kevin's word, of normalize, right? This pilot has a highly abnormal situation. We'll call it an emergency. It is. But the closer this pilot can get to what is familiar and reasonable and within the bounds of what they know, the more likely it's going to turn into something that's survivable. And as Dave pointed out at the very beginning, maybe even like a non-event, how normal this feels making this approach. We are going to put in the hangar a link to a video of this same kind of thing happening to a Cherokee pilot. And they made a long straight in approach and it's all captured on video. And yeah, I was feeling really nervous for them for the exact reason Paul said. I'm like, boy, you're going to land short when you kill that mixture. Or you're going to run off the end of the runway. And the pilot nailed it. Not a problem at all. They did everything right. They roll off the runway. But you can see the adrenaline hit after they get out and it's all over. Totally calm until that point. And then, oh my gosh, what just happened to us? So that's really the takeaway here. I think you normalize and think about these really oddball situations that could happen because they actually can happen to you. And they might even apply to a more common situation that you can funnel into something you're more familiar with.